Hello?
Hello, is this Mr. Garfunkel?
Yes, it is. How come you're so reticent?
Hey, this is Jason in WTOP in D.C. How are you?
I'm very pleased to talk to a man whose punctuality is perfect.
Wow, all right, I'll take that. That's a nice little compliment.
Here I am waiting, wondering, is this one of those A-plus guys who's right on the money? Yes, it is.
Well, hopefully he'll say the same at the end of the interview.
Well, who knows? I don't know how to do these things. Life is too fabulous. It's too wide. It's got too many parts. How can we talk about it?
Absolutely. But we're going to give it a shot to talk about it. All right, sir?
Okay. All right.
I guess let's just start off, like, you know, what can we expect to hear? I know, obviously, we'll have, you know, your solo hits, the Simon and Garfunkel classic stuff. But I also think I saw you're going to play some cuts from some of your favorite songwriters. You know, the Randy Newmans, George Gershwins.
That's Jim, right.
Which of those songs are you going to be doing?
Well, if you're a singer, you can do anything, whatever matches your voice. I've been singing since I was 5. I was a crooner singing in the alleyway in Queens. I will do, I used to do Jobim. I don't do that now. I have 12 solo CDs. On the solo CDs, there's songs from all kinds of writers from the early 20th century. You hit some of the highlights that I'll be singing. I'll do half Simon and Garfunkel and half of those, whatever you call them, anything, any song that's great. There's a somebody I'm longing to see, George Gershwin. Mm. I'll put that in the set.
Awesome. Aren't you also going to give us a little bit of a teaser of your upcoming autobiography?
Well, yeah, I've been writing this thing not knowing what I was doing, just following the pen to paper whenever inspiration would get me, and out would come these sort of prose poems. They would consume the week, and I realized I'm a bit of a writer, and I'll shop them around, see if I can get a publisher to agree. And yes, now a book of mine, My Life, is coming out in September of this year, and it has a lot of these little one-minute jobs. And I serve them up on stage, a few of them, between the songs. It works.
I like that. You get to hear a song, and then you get to hear a little bit of your roots in between. I really liked it. And it's called What Is It All But Luminous, right? So keep an eye out for that in September, folks.
What is it all but luminous?
Notes from an Underground Man. Speaking of these little autobiographical bits that we're going to hear, let's dive into that a little bit. Take us back to the very beginning in Queens. Tell me about your parents, Jack and Rose. What were they like? God, that just dawned on me. Those are the characters in Titanic. But they were your parents first, damn it. Jack and Rose.
Jack and Rose were a middle-class Jewish family whose parents came from Eastern Europe, but they grew up in America in the Lower East Side of New York. Dad was a traveling salesman. They were musical in an amateur way. We had a piano in the living room. Nobody was serious about trying to get on the charts, except me. And that was my Queens background. My friend Paul Simon was 3 blocks away, and that got us together.
That's awesome. Yeah, you mentioned that you were blocks away from Paul. Take our listeners, especially maybe some of our younger listeners, that don't know about Tom and Jerry at the school dances. I know you guys cross paths at some school plays, talent shows, that kind of thing. Explain the early days with the whole moniker Tom and Jerry and how you actually pivoted into forming the actual Simon and Garfunkel.
Well, I just left off saying I made this friend, Paul Simon. We were in the 6th grade. We were as old as my younger boy is now, little Bo. 11 years old, and we started singing, and we followed Alan Freed on the radio. He was showing this new subversive music called rock and roll, and we harmonized and wrote our tunes, and we started bringing our songs into New York City to the Brill Building. We signed a contract. They called us Tom and Jerry. We never could find a name. And we had a minor hit record called Hey School Girl when we were high school seniors. This is very exciting stuff for a 16-year-old kid.
Absolutely.
Making a few $1,000, going to college on that money, it propelled you into grown-up life.
Absolutely. So you go to college on that, and I believe it's like right after college, you guys do your debut album, and then off of that, your first big hit, and I'm obsessed with this song, The Sound of Silence. Man, there's some really complex, mysterious, almost lyrics that are going on there. The people bowing and praying to the neon god they made, and that it's the words of the prophets that are written
on this. now you go any further, I must tell you, it's Paul Simon who wrote The Sound of Silence.
Sure.
This is a question for him and his writing process and exactly what he was getting at. I sing Paul's songs with my heart and soul and my interpretation. The Sound of Silence is very urban imagery that if you light on any particular specific line, it makes me want to defer to Paul for an explanation.
I gotcha. Well, tell me about then, well, on the flip side of that, then tell me about just the singing it then and your memories of producing that on the production end then.
Well, it was one of the earliest songs that we showcased when we set ourselves for Columbia Records and did an audition at Studio A on 7th Avenue in New York back in 1964. There was Roy Halley. H-A-L-E-E, our studio engineer. We were meeting him for the first time, and we were to make all our records with him all through the years. He was so wonderful. We sang for Tom Wilson. He produced that demo session that got us onto Columbia Records, and we had four tunes. One of them was The Sound of Silence. This was the tune where Artie sang the lead vocal, "Hello, darkness, my old friend." I'm the tenor. I'm in front there. Paul's doing the supportive harmony. And what can I say about it? We liked it. When we were finished with those four tunes, we left the studio today hoping that Columbia would sign us, but feeling very good about our performance. Jason, what I remember most is Paul called me, and that night, "Artie, how come you're not the greatest singer?" "How come you're not the greatest singer?" That was his way of saying, "You did good work today. I think we got signed to Columbia Records." This is Queens slang, where you, in those days, you say things in reverse.
Hey, take it however it's phrased.
That's the sound of Paul and Arthur.
There it is right there. Oh, that's fantastic. Well, so you got signed. That's great. And then another one coming up soon after that. Scarborough Fair off your Parsley, Sage, Rosemary, and Thyme album. My parents had that one, and I actually have the vinyl of it now. They passed that one down, so I listen to that one quite often. How did you, from a production side, I always thought that one kind of had like a hypnotic, almost dreamlike quality.
Yeah, it's very flowy. Flowy. It has. It's a very organic, unforced musical attempt. You hop aboard and you ride it.
But go into sort of the musicality of how you create that dreamlike quality.
Well, it starts with Paul Simon, a very talented musical cat. The song is, he didn't write it, it's an old folk song. I wrote the counter melody that goes between the lines. It's an old English ballad. Its secret is in Paul's beautiful picking guitar. We recorded it at a studio in New York that took acoustic guitar sounds and really made it beautiful. Roy Halley made the most of that, those six strings of Paul's Martin guitar. And the naturalness and the ease and the rhythm of Paul's playing made the vocals so effortless. And the record was almost complete when you have two vocals and that wonderful guitar. But we added parts. You know, you overdub. If you come to my concert at the Kennedy Center, July 8th, this is one of the bits I'm going to go into.
Oh, you're going to do it? All right.
I'm going to do the song that I wrote that is the counter melody between the lines of Scarborough Fair. So I'll get to that song. It's an... I'll explain it on stage.
Yeah, there was your teaser, folks, but if you want to get the whole story, you got to come out to the show. That's awesome.
Correct.
Obviously, that one and Sound of Silence, we can't think of them without The Graduate, of course, which is easily one of my all-time favorite movies. You can, because they existed before. But pivoting into that a little bit, because obviously you've had a long relationship with the late Mike Nichols, who directed that. Take me into when you guys were plucked to do Mrs. Robinson. Originally, wasn't it going to be Mrs. Roosevelt, and you had to change it to Mrs. Robinson at Nichols' request?
Well, yes, that's the story. We were new to Hollywood. We had just met Mike. He was looking for four songs. We never came up with anything except what was pre-existing, and Mike began to live with the songs we already had. And he started loving Sound of Silence and Scarborough Fair, so he got it down to one. "Can you give me one new song?" And we struggled. And I said to Mike, "Well, Paul has a song he's been working on. This is the latest thing called Mrs. Roosevelt." da 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 dee, Mrs. Roosevelt, Jesus loves you. Now, Mike says the obvious. All these things look so obvious when it's after the fact, Jason.
Yeah, of course.
Mike says, you had a song called Mrs. Roosevelt, and you didn't think how obvious that would be for Mrs. Ron? Of course, we say, well, let's try it. And it worked fine, and it's just, there's your story. I better not go any further.
No, that's awesome. But in doing the switch there, though, Mrs. Robinson's sort of, you know, she's the antagonist of the movie. But the fact that now you just swap the name, and now that it says, you know, Jesus loves you more than no, does it give her a little bit of a redemptive quality in the end?
I don't think so. I think you're being a writer now, Jake. That's a bit of a constructed theory, I think. I think that Paul, as the writer, would probably say, no, we writers fool around. Whatever slots in with the right syllables. There's a lot of fooling around, whatever works, that a writer uses.
Absolutely. Well, the thing that, regardless of the lyrics, the part that I love, your guitar slows down as Dustin Hoffman's car runs out of gas. There's so many times where it's perfectly timed. Did you guys perform it that way, or is that Nichols' idea, or how did that actually work?
We worked a picture there in Hollywood on the big sound stage, a giant room with a huge screen that has your movie at the end. The picture dictated Paul's performance, and he's staring there with his neck craned up at the screen, getting exactly the rhythm we want to match picture. It's craftsmanship, it's musicianship.
Absolutely. And did you ever run into Ann or Dustin shortly after that? Tell us
what
they were.
Yeah, I ran into Dustin in an office building in the lobby in New York City. After that, I don't think we had met until then. We both shared that enormous success, but we never worked together. It's Mike Nichols who brought it all together. And I got a huge bear hug from Dustin, and that brilliant smile he has that's so incandescent. He was a doll.
Absolutely. And of course, Anne Brankaroff, you mean you gave her career role with that song, so that's just fantastic.
No, she was very established as a great actress and a great woman before that role.
Right, miracle worker and the rest, you're right.
Yeah.
But transition a little into, because you started doing a little acting for Nichols after that, Catch 22, Carnal Knowledge. I think you got a Golden Globe nod for the nomination for the latter. Take me into that transition. Did Mike, you know, working with you, as on the soundtrack of The Graduate, did he say, hey, you might have something here as an actor, or was that more your idea?
It was Mike's idea. I was not pursuing an acting career. After I did Catch 22 for Mike, a small role, I guess he felt Artie can do this stuff. And he had a Jules Pfeiffer script called Carnal Knowledge prepared, and it's all Mike being the protagonist and me responding.
Absolutely. I just have your music and movies sort of on the brain because I just saw that movie Baby Driver, which was the B-side to The Boxer.
It has nothing to do with the Simon and Garfunkel song Baby Driver, does it?
He uses it in the soundtrack. The whole movie, we won't sidetrack too much, but the whole thing is about a getaway driver who has a ringing in his ears, so he has to wear iPod earbuds the whole time, and he creates little playlists. But
and there's the movie soundtrack right there.
Yeah, it's like a wall-to-wall soundtrack, which I know you guys basically invented that back in the 60s,
now the whole movie is how's his musical taste. If he has long lay down Sally, then it's a good movie.
You're gonna have to check it out to see. I really enjoyed it. It's Edgar Wright. We interviewed him last week. But anyway, I bring up Baby Driver because a lot of people forget that it's the B-side of The Boxer. How'd you come up with the Lie, Lie, Lie?
How did we come up with Lie, Lie, Lie? I don't know. Jason, that's the absence of a lyric. When you don't have a lyric, you sing La La La. Again, after the fact, these things look important.
Right, right.
Before the fact, they're things you stumble into and you're obliged to give an explanation to, and here I am, obliged.
Speak to sort of how, when you're listening to that song, it almost paints a picture. You can, I mean, this is like, I don't know if it's Rocky Balboa or whatever, but you can picture that guy, that fighter, he's scrapping along.
Well, if you sing it well and effectively, you can really picture it. This is my job. This is my whole life. I know. I would say you'd be amazed how that song could fall flat if the singer didn't put some shine into it.
Well, you guys definitely made a shine. That's great.
Well, and so did Roy Halley. That's The Boxer is a terrific production. It feels like it's got $90 million of production in it. It's so worked on and fixed and polished and erased and redone. And it doesn't sound it, but it's a real labor of love.
Oh, that's so great. Well, we could go through so many of your other songs, but let's just maybe do one more. If we got to get you Bridge Over Troubled Water, in closing, I think it's just one of the most beautiful songs about friendship, companionship, you know, similar to like Carole King's You've Got a Friend or something. But
I agree. It's a great song.
I believe it was your last album with Paul, you know, so ironically, there was Troubled Water there for you. But take me sort of into the post-Paul Simon years. I know you guys reunited in 82 for that famous concert in Central Park and a subsequent tour, but how much contact have you guys had since then? Do you guys ever stay in contact, or is that just sort of, you know, good memories from the past?
Wouldn't you like to know, Jason? Do you mind if I tease you a little bit?
Yeah, that was a nice cryptic.
I went under the belt there just for a moment. I'm sorry.
No, that was great.
like seasons, we have warm periods, we have cool periods. It's still, you know, we leave it alone. A friendship is fun when you're tickled by the same things in life, and then it's left alone when you're not.
There you go. Like the seasons. April comes, she will. I love it. That's awesome. All right. Well, final question. I heard a little interesting tidbit about you, that you're a bit of a bibliophile, if you will. You've read over 2,000, have kept like a list since the 68 of all the books you've read.
1,162.
I love it. Dude, I'm the same way with movies. You call out a year, I can tell you what came out. It's like a savant thing. Are you that way? Can you, if you say...
Yeah, it's our anal compulsive thing.
So wait, if I say a year, you can say the book that came out that year?
No, I don't do it that way. I just list them all, and I have them written down. I would go to my list.
Oh, that's great. Well, I know it's impossible to pick a favorite of all those, but is there one that comes in the close to the ballpark of...
Well, it's a question I've been asked many times, so I have my answer, and it's the true answer, so I'll go to it. War and Peace, Leo Tolstoy, pretty good book.
It just became a Broadway show, yeah.
What a book. It deserves its fabulous reputation.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, hopefully somewhere on that list will be your autobiography when it comes out in September. Everybody go check it out. But first, come to the Kennedy Center on Saturday, July 8th, and you get to hear bits of the autobiography in between the songs. So,
thank you, Jason. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. Art Garfunkel on WTOP, everybody. Thank you so much, sir. This was great.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.